No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, I have Yuri Raskin with the Fend, Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. After that, I'll have Tiffany Cole running for District 1 Sun Prairie City Council. Following Ms. Cole, I will finish off the first hour of Jenna Pope. She is a local Madison activist and community organizer, and Arthur Cole Riggs, who is a video journalist. And they're going to discuss their recent arrests and the lack of rights in our state capitol. We started that discussion last week. It cut off a little early, so I wanted to bring it back this week and finish that. In the second hour, I'm going to start it off with Scott Wyckoff from Badger Democracy. We'll be talking about his latest blog, Scott Walker Cites ALEC Influence Study that Wisconsin is Turning Around. That probably take up most of the time, but there's another blog he's got out there about the legislative session as well. So we'll try to sneak that in at the end. I will be talking with Kelly from Politiscoop. We're going to be discussing the Bo Morrison case and the problems they got from writing about it. Probably speak a lot more on the Bo Morrison case. They've been really good. Politiscoop's been phenomenal about following that case. I think they've written four or five blogs about it. So they are right on top of this. It'll be really great to talk with her about what's going on in that case. And I'm going to finish out the hour of Kevin Kane from Citizen Action Wisconsin. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court case and its effect on Wisconsin. So we don't have a lot of time with him. We'll see what we can get through. But the Supreme Court case has been really important this week, and I wanted to mention it and see how those decisions would affect Wisconsin and when we're looking for those decisions to be done. The phone number to call in is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions there. Now, I have this really neat I got this announcement. It was about a really neat play, and I'm more than happy to announce plays or anything that's going on in the state of Wisconsin, but this one I thought was really unusual, so I want to let everyone know about it. It's from a Stage Q. Stage Q is proud to present This Beautiful City, the name of the play, at the Bartell Theater in downtown Madison from March 30th to April 14th, 2012. It's a docu-musical that tells the stories of the citizens of Colorado Springs, Colorado, the epicenter of American Christian evangelicalism. This Beautiful City illuminates the thoughts of the dozens of characters, conservative Christians, atheists, secular progressives, city employees, and a Celtic Wiccan, all vying to describe the place of religion in their community. Every leading church in the area participated in the project, as did numerous civic organizations, progressive activists, and individuals from all walks of life. If you'd like more information or to make reservations for This Beautiful City, you can go to the Stage Q website at stageq.com or call 608-661-9696, extension 3. I just thought that was kind of a neat show, and I know it's important that we start talking about coming together as a state. And that's one area I think that would help facilitate this coming together. So if you guys are in Madison, around Madison, it might be a really neat thing to see. So go to stageq.com. With that, I am going to bring in Yuri Raskin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Good morning, Yuri.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It sounds like you've had a lot of coffee this morning. You are just on a roll over there, just getting in all this information in the first 3 or 4 minutes of the show. I was just trying to barely take notes. I'm like, gosh, so much is going on.
It is. Luckily there's not more going on, or else it would keep going. You wouldn't even have a segment. It would be like, here's Yuri. All right, thanks. Time to go.
Right. I'll be just like speed reading.
Yep.
Like
auctioneering.
And yes, there you go. Going once, going twice. All right. Recall certified. Okay. So getting back to the news and maybe slowing down a little bit for those people who are just waking up on this beautiful Friday morning in Wisconsin. It kind of feels like spring, sort of. The next 67 days in Wisconsin may give new meaning to the term battleground state, because the Government Accountability Board is going to confirm the validity of 900,938 signatures to remove Walker, and 808,920 signatures to dismiss Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. And, of course, the minimum required was only 540,000. 208. So we're nearly doubled that number. Granted, we didn't get quite to the million, and I think it's just hilarious how people on the other side are so concerned anytime somebody mentions a million, because by golly, we didn't get to a million. Well, we still got about 360,000 more than we needed to out there. Maybe it doesn't look quite as good on a bumper sticker, but once we recall Scott Walker, it will be better, period. So that's kind of the news number one, I think. It just came out this morning, and frankly, I'm not sure when the specific certification is going to take place, but it's been announced that it's going to take place, and so I think the celebrations are breaking out. Now we're starting to look at who's going to run against Scott Walker, and really, this is getting to be the time for candidates to begin to announce. However, of course, we have several candidates that already announced that they're running. We have Kathleen Falk, who was the first one out of the gate, and we have State Senator Kathleen Vinehout, who is also campaigning and actually was here in Janesville not too long ago. And we have Doug LaFollette, who has just recently announced that he is going to run as well. You may have remembered that Governor LaFollette is something that is very near and dear to anyone in Wisconsin, because we have history of a great guy named LaFollette being involved in our state politics, not to mention that Doug LaFollette himself has been in state politics for decades. And the big question becomes then, what is Tom Barrett, current mayor of Milwaukee, going to do? Is he going to announce that he's running for challenge Scott Walker? Because the latest polling shows him as the most reasonably likely candidate to beat Scott Walker. But, of course, Mr. Barrett himself has a re-election race and election to, I guess, win first before he is likely to announce anything. Still, I think it's reasonable to expect within the next few days to learn of more candidates. So we'll go from there. Interestingly enough, Mr. Barrett hasn't announced exactly who he is running against, as in, I don't know, we can always start a rumor that he'll be running for the Senate, but well, let's stick with a recall for now.
I would say, let's not start any more rumors. We already have a bunch out there. He did send out a letter, though, talking about his fight against Walker, or against Walker, because Walker's ads are apparently attacking Barrett, which I found interesting. He just had Rahm Emanuel, who is the mayor of Chicago. He just came up for a fundraiser for Barrett. And another little thing going on is that there are supporters for Barca for running for governor. Now, Barca, Representative Barca, has not said one way or the other either. He's not made up his mind as well, but apparently his supporters are going forward and they're collecting the 2,000 to 4,000 signatures needed. So there's a huge push on Facebook to collect signatures for Representative Barca, who has yet to announce he's running.
That is an excellent point. And I think that we're now starting to get a pretty good flavor of what this race is going to be about. It's going to be a very brief race, only 67 days from here until the election day. But it's going to be, you know, we're in Wisconsin giving a new name to Battleground State, a new meaning, because this is going to be some exciting few weeks here.
Especially if you like to vote. This is a really good place. If you really like elections, you are in the right state this year.
Well, and what makes you more likely to vote than to have a good race? And we're going to have several. We also have a governor who managed to set up lots of elections on the same dates as much as he could possibly control, in a sense that we have a spring election coming up on Tuesday, which is standard spring election all over Wisconsin, city council, school boards, county judges, all of that exciting kind of stuff. But now we're also going to have a GOP presidential primary on that same date. So we're going to have, hopefully, lots of people showing up, which is a good thing. But we're also going to have lots of people coming out, well, maybe not as many as they would hope for, but somebody's going to come out to decide whether Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, or Ron Paul gets the Republican votes in Wisconsin. That means that the Republican turnout is going to be disproportionately higher than you would otherwise expect to see in a spring primary, which means that it's really important for those that want to support good progressive candidates in our local offices, as is going to be, sounds like, your next guest, to turn out and vote. Because we do have Paul Ryan and Newt Gingrich and all the excitement of Rick Santorum and Ron Paul in our great state right now, and that, which is kind of the next batch of news we can get to.
That's right. They're all here with speeches, with Santorum, who has been in and out since last week, and Mitt Romney's been in and out, and Calista Gingrich, which is his wife, has been around, Newt Gingrich's wife.
Did you just say that Rick Santorum was in and out?
Of the state.
Oh, okay.
Of the state. Rick Santorum has the wonderful distinction of having my favorite quote so far of the election year, and I don't believe it's something I can even read on the air, although he said it, and it's wonderful, and I've posted it on Facebook. So Rick Santorum right now is kind of like my favorite guy to watch and listen to.
There is something to be said for our good progressive folks to go and vote for Rick Santorum. You know, just reasonably thinking about it, do you want Mitt Romney to wrap up his nomination and march on and concentrate on Obama? Or do you want Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum to continue duking it out in what's been just a hilarious circus of irrelevance, in my opinion? But you have Rick Santorum saying that Wisconsin is where he's going to make his stand. So, you know, I think that it just about behooves us to go and help Rick Santorum to continue with his battle, because it sure is entertaining.
Matt Rothschild has decided he was going to endorse, I believe, or push, or I think it was Matt Rothschild to it could have been John Nichols. It's one of those two decided that Newt Gingrich was the guy to go with. So they endorsed. One of them endorsed him. So, but I have there's a question here in the chat room. What's the word on the voter ID injunction? So why don't we cover that real fast? We only have a couple minutes left.
Sure. It doesn't sound like, you know, there's anything new particularly that's coming up right there at this point. There's, of course, another appeal pending, and we'll see where it goes. But at this point, the spring elections are as they always were, from what I understand, and from everything I'm reading and seeing out there, in a sense that you do not need a voter ID to go and vote in a spring election. So the rules as they were before all the excitement of Fitzwater stand.
And that's good. So hopefully we could get more people out that way who maybe had an ID issue, especially some of the older people, some of our elderly, and some of our students who can go and speak their mind and vote this time around where there won't be an issue with that. Although I think you still have to sign the poll books. So.
Well, since we have just a couple more minutes, let's jump on a few more pieces of news that should be covered. First of all, we have Scott Walker, who is blaming the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, for the slow growth in the economy, which is just such Scott Walkerism. He actually blames health care reform for slow job growth, saying that business owners are uncertain about what this is going to do to them, and therefore they're not hiring. We have University of Wisconsin students for turning out in mass for Ron Paul. And Ron Paul, as far as I can tell, is the only GOP candidate to actually campaign in Madison area. But you can see that the supposed freedoms that Ron Paul advocates would be appealing to student population. We have Newt Gingrich, who is giving comments and making statements at Marquette University. Paul Ryan, who endorsed Romney and will campaign with him in Wisconsin. What are the chances of this being a Romney-Ryan 2012 ticket, R&R? Just about, you know, talk about two guys who'd like to get off the political stage for good. And we have Romney, who leads Santorum in Wisconsin. Of course, Santorum was in Janesville just a couple of days ago, and there's some great video footage of that if anybody's looking. We have it at the Wisconsin News Roundup. How about that?
That's good. You're right on time, too. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. Yuri, hold on. We're going to be right back with Tiffany K.O. I think I said that right. K.O., yes. Here I am. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The amazing thing about the right-wing Supreme Court challenge to Obama's health care policy is that it was totally unnecessary. It would have been impossible if Obama had offered a robust public option like Medicare for all who want it, rather than forcing people to buy private insurance, largely from the companies who've been ripping us off every step of the way. Obama could have and should have given people a choice. If you want to keep your private health insurance provider, fine. But if you want the government, in essence, to be your insurer, then just join the Medicare program. It would be open to all, and my bet is that everyone but the most drunken devotee of Ayn Rand would have left it the Medicare for all option. Why? Because most people on Medicare are very happy about the coverage they get and grateful for the program. Just ask someone who's on it. It's not perfect, but it's a whole lot better than the private insurance market offers you. And the administrative costs aren't bloated because huge amounts of money aren't wasted on CEO salaries and glossy ad budgets. Unfortunately, Obama failed to present the option of Medicare for all who want it. Instead, he bought in and told everyone under 65 to buy in to the private insurance model. And that's the core of his problem today at the Supreme Court. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show. We are speaking now with Tiffany Keogh. I know I'll get that right eventually. I'm sorry, Tiffany. She's candidate.
That's fine.
She is running for District 1 Sun Prairie City Council. Well, I'd like to welcome you to the show today, and we've got Yuri on who will also ask you some questions.
Okay. Great.
So I wanted
Hello
to ask.
There.
I wanted to ask you, why did you decide to run for City Council?
I decided to run for City Council because Sun Prairie is one of the fastest growing cities in Dane County, and there has been explosive growth in that city, and I don't feel all of the populations are being fairly represented in the current City Council. So I wanted to bring a new, fresh perspective, a progressive voice to our City Council.
What do you feel that would be the first thing you would do if you get elected or when you get on the board?
The first thing that I would do in City Council is to first sit at the table with all of the current City Council members and try to understand where we are at collectively as a city and where we are trying to go, as well as to inject my perspective of what I experience as a homeowner in Sun Prairie, as a parent of three kids that go to the school district, and as a minority in Sun Prairie. I think that Sun Prairie City Council is missing a very important voice for a huge growing population in that city, and I definitely want to bring representation to that.
Tiffany, I was curious. Thank you very much for running. I think, first of all, it's just great that, you know, whenever I see somebody stepping up and running for local government, it's always, first of all, a thank you because you're looking to serve your community, and that's awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you.
How do you feel your background has prepared you to serve on a council? I see that you're a member of Madison Network of Black Professionals. You're a member of Sun Prairie Youth Family Commission. You have a pretty good record, I mean, really a substantial record on community involvement. But how do you feel that prepares you to serve your community in this capacity?
Well, the main thing that my background brings is a broad wealth of experience and just being able to speak to a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds and perspectives. I moved here from Milwaukee, which is one of the notorious, most segregated cities in Wisconsin. Literally, the city is divided by the haves, the have-nots, ethnicities, diversity. I mean, there are so many differences in that city. And as I moved to Sun Prairie, first, I lived in Milwaukee. I moved to Madison about 6 years ago. So that was a culture shock from Milwaukee to Madison. And then from Madison to Sun Prairie, once again, it is so that my perspective brings the view of the haves and the have-nots. You know, the old Sun Prairie, the new Sun Prairie, the homeowners versus the renters. And I think those divides are really stalling our city from all the opportunities that present itself in this growth. And I think that I can bring a very unique voice to that because I've seen it before, and I've seen what happens when you embrace diversity, and I see what can happen when you just try to just not talk about it and act like it doesn't exist, and how you can absolutely create a division among your constituents, and that's not good. So I think that, once again, when I bring this fresh new perspective that includes a lot of different voices that have not been heard before, I think that was clearly identified in the Recall Walker campaign. There's a lot of pent-up frustration in that city, and I've talked to people, I've knocked on doors, I've spoken with seniors that feel their voices aren't being heard. So it's not just a, you know, black and white thing. It's a diversity. It's a changing demographics. It's a young workforce. It's an aging population. There's a lot of changes going on in Sun Prairie, and I want to represent all of those changes. I want to be that ear. I want to be that voice.
So you're a new and fresh voice, and that I think that's very clear. Excellent. What do you feel that if you could tell the listeners a little bit more about what is it that you do when you're not going to be serving, you know, when you're not on a council, what do you do with the rest of your time?
Well, for one, I'm a parent, I'm a wife, I'm a homeowner, so those things right there keep you quite busy. As far as my civic engagement, as you did mention, I am a member of the Madison Network of Black Professionals, and I co-chair the partnership committee. So right now we are really focused on building new partnerships that focus on economic development, and there's a lot of companies that are embracing diversity in their workforce. So working with establishing those relationships, as well as continuing my work with the Sun Prairie Youth and Family Commission and working with the YMCA of Dane County to implement this community schools initiative that is so very exciting. It's a national initiative, and Sun Prairie is, the Y is hoping to make Sun Prairie the pilot. Because the population, the change, the multiple demographics as they relate to socioeconomic status, one school may have a higher percentage of children that receive low, free, or reduced lunch. And that can really impact the services that the child receives, their education. So community schools, instead of trying to build more brick and mortar, the community schools initiatives puts those services in the schools, and each school has a different culture, each family, each child. So that's a very exciting initiative. We've really been working hard on that, and as well as just, you know, attending. I have a son that's graduating from high school. That's so very exciting, and you know, all the exciting developments that go on as he pursues his pursuits in life. And so I'm just so excited about everything. There's so many new opportunities that are presenting itself in Sun Prairie and just in Dane County in general. And I really want to be that connector, because for some reason, Sun Prairie has always had this sense that we're Sun Prairie and that's Madison, that's them over there. But as this city grows, our backyard is Madison. So we need to learn to talk to people and bring everyone to the table instead of this divisive political rhetoric that is really damaging. You know, the services is really impacting our community in a negative way.
Tiffany, this is Sarah again.
What
are the two major problems that you see facing Sun Prairie?
The two major problems that I see, for one, is transparency, and the other major problem, I would say, is transportation. Transparency in government, I have always, when I first moved to Sun Prairie, it was really hard for me to try and figure out what is going on, like who's making decisions and how are rules made, until at that time, Mayor Joe Chase, he was the mayor, and he had Hey Joe, What Do You Know, his show on the Sun Prairie public media, and that's how I started learning about city council and, you know, where the decisions are made. And unless I think I'm very unique in myself, that I found that interesting. But for those that don't find it interesting, how are they finding out about city government? How are they finding out about rules that are being made that impact their taxes? It's all connected. So I think transparency is very big. A lot of people have no idea. In fact, a lot of people have just tuned out altogether because they're feeling like their voice doesn't make a difference. And that is a very dangerous, that's very dangerous, because people need to be engaged. And in order for people to want to engage, they need to know what's going on in simple terms. If you make this decision, this is how it impacts your taxes. You know, it all leads back to taxes and how much money people have to pay and how people can take care and support their families. So transparency is a big deal. My second one is transportation. There was a comprehensive report done in 2008 that specifically stated that the lack of a transportation infrastructure in Sun Prairie is hurting Sun Prairie. When I first began addressing this issue, the response I kept getting was, well, if people want to get around, they can catch the cab. And that our transportation right now in Sun Prairie is either people have their own cars or their Sun Prairie taxi. And I think it's an excellent service. I think Sun Prairie taxi service is an excellent service for those who need it can serve. However, there's a lot that has changed since 2008, specifically the population. We have a lot of people that live in Sun Prairie that work in Madison. The Sun Prairie taxi, unless you catch the taxi and you have plans to go to Easttown Mall, and that's it. That's as far as the Sun Prairie taxi will go. But we have a lot of people that work at the university, downtown. You know, we need to build that connection up from Sun Prairie to other parts of this county in order to attract more businesses for economic development, so they will feel likely to put their business in Sun Prairie because they can get their employees to work. It all goes back to, you know, economics and being able to serve the people and give them what they need and listen. You have to be willing to listen and take your own political rhetoric out of the picture. And I think that has become a bigger problem as of late.
All right, we have about 2 minutes left, and I was just wondering, you mentioned about a TV program called Hey Joe, What Do You Know?
You're right.
I don't hear a lot about the newspaper, so does Sun Prairie have a local newspaper, and how are they, or how are they not helping with
really
getting information out?
That. Yes, I'm really glad you mentioned that. Sun Prairie does have a local newspaper, and it's the Sun Prairie Star, and it is of my opinion that you only get one side of a story. And I really don't think that the Sun Prairie Star captures both sides of the story, no matter what side of the aisle you sit on. I mean, I think that the media has a responsibility to display the entire picture, not just one side of it. Or There's a couple articles in particular that I know we only have 2 minutes, so I won't go into, but I would suggest that if there's anyone else that maybe has a paper that has more of a progressive voice, they bring it to Sun Prairie, because people need to see the whole picture and not just one side of it.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. What's a website where people can go to get more information about you before the election on Tuesday?
Absolutely. The website is www.keogh4council. So that's keogh4council.com. radioforcouncil.com.
Well, good luck, Tiffany. It sounds like you've got a great campaign, and you have a great web page with lots of information about you over there. And I think everyone that is curious about what's going on in Sun Prairie should check it out.
Yes, and I absolutely please encourage everyone to get involved, get engaged, get educated about local government, because there's a lot going on that people are missing. So get engaged. Don't tune out.
Well, thank you so much for being on. Good luck, and I hopefully will have you back on again, maybe once you're even on the council. So.
Oh, I look forward to it. Thanks a lot for the invitation, Sarah.
Oh,
bye-bye.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You.
Whoops. Sorry, I cut her off a little earlier. I was just getting her off. We got to actually get to break, too. So I wanted to thank Tiffany Keo for being on the show today. And coming up next, we're going to have Arthur Coleriggs and Jenna Pope, who will talk about their court cases and the rights were taken away in Wisconsin.
We will not break. Can't be broken. Can you hear the sound? I can't see where this is going. Feels like it's all coming down. Feels like it's all coming down. Wanna hide in your steel tower and laugh at us who work for you. We are alive and we have power. You'll see just what we're gonna do. There's a light that shines on everyone. Not yours, not mine, but it shines. You should listen to the children, and then outside your door. They don't want your silver dollar or to be a slave anymore. There's a light that shines on everyone. Not yours, not mine, but it shines. Can't be broken. Can't you hear the sound? I can see where this is going. Feels like it's all coming down. Feels like it's all coming down. Feels like it's all coming down.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. I have Yuri Raskin, who's with me until 9:45 today, who's working, helping me with talking to the guests. And we also have Jenna Pope and Arthur Coleriggs. Jenna Pope is a amazing activist and organizer in Wisconsin, and Arthur Coleriggs is an amazing video journalist. And we were talking with them last week about their trials and about what was going on with Arthur with the camera and Jenna with her trial. And we never got into some of the other stuff with the lack of rights within the state capitol. But first I wanted to recap anything we would have missed. I know, Arthur, you went and had your trial right after the show. Can you tell everyone what happened with that, with your camera?
Yeah, it wasn't trial. It was my initial appearance with the court commissioner. So in that situation, I just said not guilty, and that was it. So I have another date scheduled for about a month from now to meet with the DA and have, that's the pretrial conference. So there hasn't really been any developments with that. I got my camera back later that day on Friday.
All right. And everything is on it? Everything's good? Everything works?
Yes, I believe so. Okay. That doesn't mean they didn't take footage off of it, and there's no way that I could tell what they did or did not look at on the camera. But it appears that everything that I shot is still on the camera.
Wonderful.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, Arthur. How's it going?
Hey, Yuri. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on getting the camera back. And
thank you.
Wanted to let you know that it looks like at least you're going to be featured in the documentary that the person is making that's going to be on PBS about Janesville in October. And
oh, really?
And this great footage that you took that when their protest at the Wisconsin Welcome Center in Beloit this past summer, when the protesters were probably like 10 feet away from Scott Walker.
Oh,
and,
cool.
My friend was there with a camera filming for PBS documentary, and you got him with your camera, and he got you with his camera. So it's great. So I was wondering, with all of this involvement and seeing, you know, that you've been in the middle of everything, and Jenna as well, what are you guys thinking about? Do you want to, like, go to law school? Do you want to get involved in different ways once Scott Walker is out of office? What does the future look like?
Oh, no law school for me. But, yeah, I mean, I'd like to stay involved, but I don't know how that will look once the recall has removed Walker from office. I'm trying to keep the options open, but hopefully it will it'll be relevant and probably will involve video.
Jenna, are you going to continue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a feeling I am always going to be involved no matter what. But also, like Arthur, I don't see myself going to law school. I do have people mention it a lot. I mean, I've learned a lot about the law specifically in Wisconsin over the past year. But I don't really have any interest in becoming a lawyer. I'm probably just going to end up being like a community organizer of some sort.
I'll
continue.
That can
doing
qualify
it.
You to be a president anyway.
That didn't sound very hopeful there. It sounds like she'd rather stay in the community organizing area and work with the community and continue to be the activist that she is. So didn't sound like any political aspirations there. So, Jenna,
so what
do you have
the next 67 days?
What?
Jenna, do you have any updates on any of your trials? Is everything done with you then? Is there any more updates with you with yours?
I actually did just, there was one more ticket that I had that hadn't been like cleared up or anything yet. That was still kind of, I was still waiting on it. And it was a ticket for filming in the Assembly Gallery. Even though I did it, there was like over the course of 2 days, I think there was like 22 or 23 people that ended up getting ticketed for, most of them were filming in the Assembly Gallery. A few of them had held signs in the Assembly Gallery. They originally told us that all of our tickets were dismissed, like on our initial court appearance or something like that. It was like a long time ago. They told us they were all dismissed. And then out of nowhere, I get a mail from the Dane County Courthouse telling me I have a court trial, it was a pretrial coming up. And so I was really confused. So I called my attorney, and it turns out they pulled a few of our files those of us that are considered repeat offenders, even though at that point none of us had been convicted of anything, all of our tickets had been dismissed, they still considered us repeat offenders. And so they pulled some of our files and didn't dismiss those. So I've had, like, I think a couple, like a pretrial and a settlement conference or something. But finally, I just actually checked last night on TCAP, and it said that it was dismissed by prosecutor's motion. So now I'm all cleared up. I've either been convicted or my tickets have been dismissed. So.
Well, it's good. So you're done then for now, and Arthur's still got a little
for
bit
now,
more
yeah.
to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully this should be resolved.
Yeah, I hope so. Very quickly. Go ahead.
What do
you
guys
can ask him.
Okay, thanks. It's exciting to do a phone conference over, like, four different phone lines, isn't it?
I do it over, like,
40
phone lines.
What is the future holds for you guys for the next 67 days? Are you going to be in Madison? Are you going to be all over the state? What does that look like for you?
You can take this first.
Okay. I'm definitely going to spend some time in Madison. I mean, I live here. But I spend a lot of time also in Milwaukee, and I'm planning on helping out in the 13th District for Lori Compass. I am planning on this weekend, they're trying to gather all of their signatures for her nomination papers, like, in 2 days. To just kind of be like, look, we can do it in 2 days. We don't need 10 days. So I'm planning on helping out with that this weekend. So I'm going to kind of just go wherever I feel like I need to be.
Yeah, I'll definitely be in and around Madison, but I plan on following the campaign action. So throughout the course of the primary and the general election, I'll be around the state filming and documenting what's going on the campaign trail, definitely with an emphasis on Lori Compass's campaign. Replacing Fitzgerald is like priority number 1.5.
Excellent.
Well, that's good to hear that you guys are going out. It's important to get some of this information out and to help out where you can. And I know that there are some really good journalists, citizen journalists like yourself, Arthur, who are going out and videotaping and writing about, but you don't normally hear about in the regular media.
Right.
So I'm glad you're going out to do that. Now, I have a quick question for you both. How, with the youth interest in politics and the recall process, how do we get them more involved? How do we bring the youth in? I know they've been a really big, and I'm kind of part of that youth aspect, actually, but you know, I've been a really big push for in the recall. They've been a really good foundation. How do you keep them going? How do you talk to your friends and say, okay, we really got to keep involved. We really got to keep pushing this because the minute we let our guard down, you know, things happen.
Personally, the way I see the youth, I'm air quoting that, getting more engaged and involved in this election, not to say it's too late for this general election, but just maintaining the messaging that Scott Walker is messing up the job climate for us now, and the jobs that Scott Walker is keeping from Wisconsin are going to our neighboring states. The rest of the country is seeing significant progress where we stall behind. And it's the recent graduates. It's the, you know, the people who are looking for their first salaried, you know, full-time job that are kind of being hit the hardest. You know, moving back in with their parents have a lot at stake here. And so if you can get them engaged, because, you know, if they understand the consequences and what's really at stake, hopefully they can participate and engage their friends.
I think that's excellent. I think that having that message that can connect to as many people and make it very personal and direct to them is the way to do it, because just saying Scott Walker is evil and recall Scott Walker is it almost becomes old because we've been talking about it for so long.
Yeah.
To remind people exactly how it is hurting them and how it is affecting their children and how it is affecting their parents and how it is affecting their world, I think is absolutely vital.
Yep.
Jenna, do you want to answer that at all, or are you just going to go with what Arthur said?
Well, I definitely agree with what Arthur said. I do want to just cover like high school students and college students, which are obviously included in the youth. And it's obviously been really, really hard to keep them engaged. I remember actually getting really angry when I would go onto the UW-Madison campus to collect recall signatures. And I could not believe how many students were just completely oblivious to what was going on. Like, I'd ask so many people if they want to sign, and they were just like, no, thanks. And I mean, I understand that some people just don't want to sign, but most of them realized, or it seemed like they didn't really have an opinion one way or the other, and they were kind of just like, well, I'm walking to class, like, don't bother me. Like, they just didn't get that it was going to affect them as UW students. So I think that's one way to target students, is to just keep hitting the facts that, you know, there were all these cuts from the UW system, and that's going to cause our tuition to go up. I can't remember who I was talking to, but it sounds like tuition is possibly going to be going up like 15% or something like that. And I mean, I heard this from a friend or something. But they were explaining why, and it made sense to me. I mean, it's normal for tuition to go up, but it's usually been like, you know, like a 5% increase. So it's, students are already having a hard time paying for college with the increases in the past years, but it sounds like it's going to go up quite a bit this year, quite a bit more than normal. So,
if I could interrupt, it only seems normal for tuition to go up. It isn't. It doesn't need to be normal. It has become something that people have become used to. But there's no reason for tuition to continue to increase the way that it does. There's no need for it to gradually increase the way that people have grown accustomed to it increasing. It only does that because of funding shortfalls that are brought on to them by the lack of funding from the state. Also, the GAB just certified the recall election.
Yeah. And that was a great way to change the subject. But I think it is really, the other thing is important is to talk to people, because if they're not sure or they don't know whether they support Walker or not, it just means that they haven't connected yet. So to find out about these people, what is important to them, and chances are that people who are educated on the issue are going to figure out exactly in about, you know, 5 seconds or 30 seconds what it is that Scott Walker is doing that is hurting this particular person that they may not even be aware of. You know, so if their concern is senior citizens and taking care of their parents, then there's something there. If they, you know, just listen to the people that you talk to and figure out how Scott Walker is harming them, I think it's just a good strategy, frankly.
Yuri, I'm going to cut in here, guys. I know you have to go. I'd like to thank you so much for being on, and I'll talk to you next week then.
Sounds great.
Take care, Yuri.
All right. Have a good one. Don't forget to vote. So Yuri Raskin with the Penn Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup was with me for the first 45 minutes and helping me out here. Now, I'm going to change subjects a little bit more on you guys, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the rights. I want you to tell me what your rights were before Scott Walker got in versus after Scott Walker got in. I know I've got questions. I've got a listener who wants to ask a question as well, so I want you to answer that, and then we'll get into some more. So,
well, I'll go first. I'll just say right now, I was not politically active before Scott Walker got into office, so I wasn't really paying attention then. So I won't be able to compare really all that much. It's specifically like in the Capitol, which is where we're seeing most of the rights being taken away right now. So.
Arthur?
Yeah. Well, before Walker was governor, I definitely had no trouble ever getting into the Capitol. I never faced a locked door during business hours. I never had any issues holding a camera in a public space. That was always a protected right I had. Now I've been arrested twice for that. I've never had an issue. The most recent one wasn't even for filming, just holding a camera. But overall, it's not so much as a before and after type of thing. And it's the legislative leaders as well, with the influence of Scott Walker and the power, the power relationship that they are in, allow them to have this control over the people in the building.
Right. Well, let me get to a listener, Tom. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. This is technically a question that either of your guests could answer. The comment that Jenna made a few moments ago about students is something that really resonated with me. I didn't go to college all that long ago. I graduated a bit over a decade ago. And at the time, there were a good many students who were politically active. There were politically active student organizations. And even things like policy advocacy were at least somewhat in vogue at the time. And I'm just shocked. During the months of gathering signatures to recall Scott Walker, the contacts that I had with students very much meshed with what you just described. They just didn't seem to care. Some of them didn't seem to understand it was important. Some of them seemed to get it, but they still just didn't care and wouldn't lift a finger to pitch in. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about what it's going to take to reverse that trend and get students involved again.
We'll go with, I was going to say, we'll start with Jenna, and then we'll have Arthur answer.
Honestly, I have no idea. It depends on the individual students, I think. Obviously, all of them are being affected by the cuts to their education. But obviously, that isn't a big deal for a lot of them. I don't know if their parents pay for college, so it really doesn't matter if their tuition goes up like crazy or what. And the thing that I think is weird about it is that there were so many students involved over a year ago when we were occupying the Capitol. So I think we need to, obviously a lot of them were there probably just because, it was a cool thing to do and it was right by the campus. But I do remember when I was staying at the Capitol talking to a lot of college-age students that really, really knew what was going on. They weren't there just to bang on a drum. Like, they knew what was happening and how it was going to affect them and how it was going to affect their family and future generations. So I don't know if we need to just figure out how to remind them of that, because there's a lot of people that were students that I remember spending time with and, sleeping next to the Capitol that are nowhere to be found anymore. So I think a lot of it is, like I said, just trying to figure out what really, flipped their switch at that time and try to remind them of that and hope that they get reinvolved.
Arthur?
I think there's kind of a couple sections in this question. For me, kind of responding to Jenna's point, the Capitol did see an amazing outpouring of student support during the occupation, and I think that's partially because the options for students to get involved have kind of been limited. I think a lot of people where they might have joined a club before or gone out and collected signatures, now when they feel motivated to do something, it's the internet provides such an easy out for people to want to feel like they have been involved and done something, that it kind of I fear that it can take away from the urgency for people actually to get out and do things. But I think with the capital occupation example, it's a great example of something awesome that was going on that people really felt like they could connect with and feel useful and involved and a part of. Whereas since then, it's kind of shifted directly to this electoral process, which a lot of people kind of feel is broken in the first place. And so that's not directly about students, but I think the online part of it is kind of can act as a deterrent for people really getting out onto the street and doing things. If they already shared the petition to Scott Walker asking him to restore collective bargaining, what else can they do? And so we really, I think, a job that could be useful would be to provide provide things for college students to do that really engage them in the process.
Arthur, do you sense much hope with the college and high school students?
What was the question?
Do you sense much hope with them? There seems to be a lot coming at them. There's a high, student loan rate. You have tuitions very high, lower wages. There's been studies saying that this could be the first generation that doesn't have a better life than their parents. Do the students see that? Do they have hope that they can change that, or are they just?
I don't know. I think personally, it's just kind of setting in the situation that we're in right now. And I think for a lot of people, especially students, before they've started looking for their first job, before they're out of school with their degree, I think they're really in the dark about all this, without having the experience of having a college degree and getting turned down from job offer after job offer for months, and then just not seeing any jobs, any relevant jobs in your field. I think for a lot of people, before they've gone through that experience, they really don't understand the situation that we're facing. So I think a lot of college students especially, are kind of in the economy's bad, but it won't be for me type of mindset. I'm getting a degree, I'm going to get a job, and I won't have to worry about these budget cuts.
And so you think that's part of one of the reasons they're getting out is, we won't let this happen, we will continue.
Well, I think it's the enlightenment, the moment when people really realize what's going on is kind of is stacking up on itself. And I think soon there's going to be a kind of a tipping point where the graduating class from the year before re-enrolls in school because they can't afford to start paying back their loans or something, and then the current seniors realize, shoot, there aren't going to be any jobs for us next year. But I think we're almost at the point when it stops being a partisan, left said, right said type of a thing, and it becomes a more unified struggle.
One last question for both of you. We have Oak Parker in the chat room asked, are you guys endorsing a candidate in the governor's race?
I will.
Okay. So, Arthur, you're going to wait until after the primary, or?
Sometime throughout then. I don't think the campaign mode hasn't really started yet for the race. The election was just certified moments ago. I think we'll really see platforms take shape and things like that. Right now, it's all kind of promises and things like that. I think it's a little early.
Jenna.
Well, right now the person I want to run hasn't announced one way or the other yet. I've been pushing for Peter Barca to run. If he doesn't run, I'm not sure I'd be able to endorse any candidate in the primary. I'll do what I can just to make sure people get out and vote and make sure people know, like Arthur was saying, once their platforms come out, like what each individual candidate is all about. so people can make an informed decision. But I'd probably hold out until after the primary and just throw all my support behind whoever wins that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today, guys. I know we were going to talk about one thing, and it kind of morphed into something else. Thanks for going with that. It was interesting how that all kind of got there. So thank you so much. Good luck with both
Thanks
of you.
Thanks for having us.
And hopefully I can get you guys on again sometime.
Anytime.
Right.
Take care, Sarah.
Thanks, Arthur. Thanks, Jenna. That was Arthur Cole Riggs, who is the video journalist, and Jenna Pope, who is a activist and community organizer in Madison, and we talked about their trials and everything else. And up next is Scott Witkoff with Bed to Democracy. Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. We're speaking with Scott Witkoff, the writer from Badger Democracy. Welcome, Scott, to the show.
Good morning, Sarah.
If you have any questions for Scott Witkoff, the phone number to call is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Or you can ask a question in our chat room, and I will try to get it on for him. Now, you had this really great article. I know you started out as a blogger, but you have been published. You've been in all these other things. It's not a knock on bloggers at all. I think they're amazing. But I see you more as a journalist, a writer journalist. You've been so good with all of this. And you just have a new article called Scott Walker Cites ALEC Influence Study That Wisconsin Is Turning Around. So how about we start off with a really simple description of what ALEC is, and then we can go into more of that.
Sure. Well, ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they have gotten, obviously, national publicity over the last few months because of everything that's been happening in all the states where the Republicans are in control, and very similar laws are passing on Castle Doctrine, voter ID, social engineering laws, the women's rights rollback of healthcare rights and access and workplace equity, all these laws that are passing in states like Wisconsin have their origins in ALEC. What ALEC is as Mark Pocan so succinctly put it, it's kind of a dating system that gets legislators together with corporate power and corporate money and corporate influence, and these corporations sit on the board of ALEC, and they pay thousands and thousands of dollars to be members, and they actually write the laws. So understand, 100 years ago, the actual legislators wrote the laws. Now we have this kind of shadow government in ALEC where the corporations write the laws. They give them to the legislators at the ALEC conferences and meetings and through the online system that ALEC has. And the GOP legislators at the state level push these laws through. And ALEC has been around since 1973, and they've been very, very quietly organizing and gaining power in states all over the country. And obviously the genius of ALEC is, as opposed to operating at the federal level, they've been taking over state by state by state. And, again, it's virtually a shadow government because that's where the laws are written. They get approved by the corporations before they're presented to legislators, and then the legislators take them home and push them through their state legislatures, as they have in Wisconsin over the last year. So that's a kind of a brief summation of ALEC. And Center for Media Democracy has a great website. It's called ALECExposed.org. It's all one word, ALECExposed.org, with actually links to the actual model legislation that they have a mole in the organization who's been feeding them the PDF files of the model legislation so you can view them for yourself with commentary from the Center for Media and Democracy on who the authors are, the corporations involved on these boards. So it's a very, very subversive group.
And now they're also writing studies then that support their legislation as well? Is that what Walker
right.
was using?
Well, they have a kind of an arm of their group is this, kind of legislative research and tax policy group. And the story behind the study that Walker was citing is it's a study that was put out by the Tax Foundation. Now, the Tax Foundation bills themselves as a nonpartisan, a think tank that studies and publishes on tax policy in the United States. And they issued a study that ranked Wisconsin in the top five on being business-friendly as far as taxing policy and tax systems go. Well, the interesting thing is that the Tax Foundation has a lot of ties to ALEC, including top researchers and board members and staff and executives of the Tax Foundation have multiple links to ALEC, including the person that I kind of pinpointed in the piece is Jonathan Sullivan. And Jonathan Sullivan is now the tax policy director for ALEC. 5 years ago, he was one of the top research people at the Tax Foundation. And Jonathan Sullivan is pretty famous because he was the co-author of the budget toolkit that has been used and cited by Scott Walker and so many other governors and GOP legislators around the country, this budget toolkit that was released 2 years ago. Jonathan Sullivan was the co-author for that. He was also the co-author of a book that ALEC put out called Rich State, Poor State, which used the same flawed methodology as the Tax Foundation uses to kind of put a barometer to which states were better off than others based on their corporate tax policies. So that's kind of a very direct connection between the tanks of the Tax Foundation and what they do and the think tanks of ALEC and what their agenda is. And the insidiousness of the whole thing is kind of summed up by Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and I actually have a quote from him and a link to an article he wrote back in October about the Tax Foundation, where he actually says that no knowledgeable person puts any faith in anything that the Tax Foundation publishes because it's so biased and deceptive. And I believe if you look on the article, he actually uses the word outright, or the term outright lie to describe what the Tax Foundation puts out. And I have to say, it was interesting, late last night, I actually received a comment, which I haven't approved yet because I want to reply to it, but on my blog, from the vice president of the Tax Foundation, clarifying the name of one of their kind of subgroups, which he doesn't deny anything in the article. In fact, he says that everything is pretty much fair game, and links to the piece that they wrote, which I already had linked in my blog, and you know, saying that readers should decide for themselves. Well, obviously, if you read the Tax Foundation's articles and take them at face value, they sound great. But as Krugman points out, they're using deceptive accounting methods and deceptive methodology to rationalize what they're saying. And that's what's so insidious about these conservative think tanks, like the Tax Foundation. They use flawed methodology and cherry-picked data to confirm what they want the result to be. And if I can give you just a quick example, for example, what the Tax Foundation has been doing is they're one of the groups that is pushing what's going on with the Postal Service, where the Postal Service has to fund under its current budget 75 years of pension payments against current revenues. Now, that is an outright deceptive accounting gimmick that they're using to push the fact that they want to, you know, kill the union in the Postal Service. But in reality, as has been pointed out for articles and studies, the Postal Service is actually very solvent. It's this accounting method that has been forced upon the Postal Service that has caused them to have the appearance to be in serious trouble. And there's no business that would fund 75 years of pensions against current revenues, but that's what the Postal Service is forced to do. And it's those types of methods that the Tax Foundation supports and forwards to get the result that they want. So that's the study that Scott Walker cited in his press release, which I found to be, you know, how stupid does he think the people of Wisconsin are, honestly, to believe that?
Would you say then that all the information that the Tax Foundation gives out is biased to what they want it to be? So if there's studies and four of them say it's not working and they find one study to say it is, that's all they'll cite is that it is, and they'll just pull things, or do they even make up studies to back what their legislation is by chance?
It's not even a matter of making up studies. They use existing data, and they use existing revenues and taxes, but it's the way that they present that information. For example, as Krugman says, you know, they lobbied against the Buffett rule, which would have created billions of dollars in new revenue by increasing taxes on the top, whatever, you know, what was it, 0.2%. They lobbied against that because they said that that wasn't enough. It was a drop in the bucket against what the deficit was. And as Krugman pointed out, it was a completely disingenuous argument because they were taking 10 years of deficits against 1 year of revenue. And that was how they presented their study. So that's the kind of thing they do. And they manipulate the information to forward their agenda. It's not that they're using false data. They're not. They're using accurate numbers. But it's the way they present them and the way that they're formulated that gives a very skewed appearance. And then, of course, they say that they're a nonpartisan organization, but there is a link to the Tax Foundation homepage, and you can look at their 990 filings as a private foundation, and you can see where they get their money from and where their investments are. And it's very obvious, you know, where they receive their funding from. Is very large corporations that also have links to ALEC. But it's very typical of conservative, quote-unquote, think tanks. The Bradley Foundation is another one. Obviously, MacIver Institute has become infamous in Wisconsin for, misleading information and skewed facts and things like that.
Okay, well, we'll be right back and take a quick break. We'll be right back with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, a free podcast that you can subscribe to on iTunes. Paul Ryan may have finally met his match as the Democrats are pushing a real challenger in the 2012 election. I was able to sit down with Rob Zurbon last week for an interview as he talked about his run against Paul Ryan. Zurbon admitted that he supports the bailout of GM. He supports women's rights, and maybe most importantly, he supports the current system of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Paul Ryan gained national attention last year when his budget tried to privatize Social Security and Medicare. Many people even blame Ryan and his budget for the historical flip from Republican to Democrat in New York's gerrymandered and conservative stronghold, 26th District. In 2010, Paul Ryan won with 68% of the vote. So far, Rob Zurbon is already within 6 points of Ryan, with Ryan just ahead in a 49-43 heat. Polls are showing that Ryan's support is dropping among his constituents. 54% say they approve of Ryan, but as soon as people are informed of Ryan's record, his support drops to 51% on the spot. Zurbon is a people's politician. I have personally met him 4 times now, and most of these times were several months apart. Each time, Zurbon came up to me and greeted me by name. He didn't hesitate when I asked him to do an interview, and he comes off as a modest yet effective individual. Zurbon is one of the Democratic Party's 50 most targeted races. The entire country will be watching to see if Rob Zurbon has what it takes to finally defeat Paul Ryan. I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, and that's just something to think about.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show. We're talking with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. Now, I'm going to change the subject for a minute. You had some news you wanted to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to let everybody know, I'm not sure if everybody knows who Ray Younger is, but Ray was one of the founding members of United Wisconsin on the board of directors for up until just recently. But he had a family tragedy strike earlier this week. He had a brother who was killed in an auto accident. And so, in the movement and in the community, to keep Ray Younger and his family in their thoughts, and especially his brother's surviving family. Very tragic, tragic thing. And just everybody keep him in your thoughts and, send lots of good vibes to Ray Younger and his family.
That's such a horrible tragedy. It's just...
Yeah.
It's so sad to see anyone who leaves early, and it's just Ray's a good guy, so I hate to hear that kind of stuff. So thank you for announcing that.
Sure. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but yeah, Ray is a great guy, and he's worked tirelessly since this whole thing started. And if anybody knows Ray, he's a recovering conservative, and Ray has seen what happened in Wisconsin with Scott Walker and said enough is enough. And he has put, great effort and time and personal sacrifice into the movement. So keep them in your thoughts.
Well, I'm going to get back to ALEC. There's no good way to to get off of that. I wanted to make the announcement before we got off, but there's just no way to segment anything. So I'm just going to jump into back to what we were talking about.
Right.
It's just a horrible situation there with Ray. But do you have a list of legislatures who are a part of ALEC?
Actually, I published it prior in my – it was something that I really was engaged in back in, you know, April and May and even in March when things were really going down and, you know, getting really deep into ALEC. And, again, if people go to the ALECExposed.org website, there is a state-by-state list of legislators who have confirmed ALEC ties through their statements of financial interest. Or, for example, in Wisconsin, there are several legislators who have ALEC listed in their Blue Book listing and their bios. And then, of course, Representative Pocan has been at ALEC conventions and obviously would be able to see who is at these conventions and who's involved in ALEC. And obviously, if you want to say that it's the usual suspects as far as the GOP is concerned, there are several standouts in ALEC who are, for example, chairman of certain committees and things like that. And those would be people like Leah Vukmir, Robin Voss, Scott and Jeff Fitzgerald. You have people like Dan Knodel from Southeast Wisconsin. Glenn Grossman from West Bend. And so, you know, a great many of the people who we think of as kind of the instigators of what's happened in Wisconsin and who have actually introduced this legislation. I mean, their name is on the legislation that have direct ALEC links that they've introduced. The ALEC Exposed website is a great source. Obviously, if you go on my blog and do a search for ALEC, there's, you know, a lot of articles will pop up with links to different sites, including the legislative website, so people can see who authored the bills and the direct ALEC ties to those. ALEC was formed as a response to the fact that the Great Society was working and the Republicans in power and the corporate people who were funding them were very, very afraid of losing any credibility and any relevance in the political dialogue. And they felt the only way was to start basically a propaganda machine that could tear apart and tear down the benefits of the Great Society, because it was working, and the Republicans were losing votes. And so ALEC was formed partially as a response to that. And now, one of the great things about this last year is that ALEC relied on secrecy, and it is a secret no more. There are a lot of there's a lot of information about ALEC out there. Unfortunately, the mainstream press refuses to cover it. But it's of note that, you know, many of the companies that own mainstream media are members of ALEC, such as General Electric, and which owns NBC, and so there's obviously conflicts there that they won't disclose, but they won't report. So the information is out there.
All right. I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize. Do you know if Representative Joe Klepisch, Representative Steve Nash, maybe even Judge Prosser, are they ALEC members? These are things that have come up from time to time.
Let me think. Nass, I believe Nass is. Klepisch is. I'm sorry, who's the other name you mentioned?
It was Judge Prosser.
No, I don't believe so. If he is, he would be an alumni. ALEC is which are members.
Okay,
Scott, repeat what you just said, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Repeat what you just said because it cut out a little bit. So.
Okay, sorry. ALEC is membership for state legislators. So judges and U.S. congressmen, people like that, can be honorary members, can be alumni, but they are not active members. So they focus strictly on the state legislation. Tommy Thompson is a very, very high-level ALEC alum, one of the very early members.
Really?
So, oh yes. Yep. Scott Walker is a Walker alum. Scott Walker is an ALEC alum. He was an ALEC member when he was a state. When he was an assemblyman early on in his state political career. And now, in fact, he listed ALEC in his blue book entry in his bio.
Oh. Now, I'm cutting you off again. I'm sorry. We don't have a lot of time left, so I apologize for cutting you down a little, cutting you off a little bit on this. Can any politician join? I know Mark Pocan has joined. Can other progressive politicians or Democrats or people who aren't conservative leaning join ALEC, or are they limiting that?
Well, here's the thing. They're a 501c3. And they operate as an educational foundation under the IRS tax code. So by law, they cannot exclude membership based on political affiliation. And in fact, they're not supposed to be involved in politics at all. And they've gotten away with it up to this point by claiming that they're an educational foundation. And their membership is open to anybody. And it's interesting that even though Representative Pocan is a member, and he's posted about this online. He was let out of the conference last year. He's basically shut out, even though he's a member. And there are now multiple complaints being filed with the IRS about ALEC and their dealings and their involvement in politics. So it may be very soon that we see the IRS investigating ALEC and their activities to discern whether or not they actually qualify as a 501c3 educational foundation.
I was just going to ask you, why aren't they being sued yet?
Well, as I said, there have been numerous complaints filed with the IRS. There are complaints actually have been filed with in the state of Wisconsin. There have been complaints filed. So, again, Thanks to the light of day being shined on ALEC by Center for Media and Democracy and other groups, there's a lot of daylight coming to this. So it may be very soon that we see the rats scurrying for cover and the IRS and state governments coming down on this so-called educational foundation.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It would be fantastic. Just as 900,000 recall signatures being confirmed, that's definitely something to celebrate.
It'd be nice to actually get our legislation back, our legislators back, and not have legislation be written for us, but actually have our legislators write for us.
Yep. And that's something that this grassroots movement really needs to push for. We need to push for getting back our legislative, our legislative system to be legislated, of, by, and for the people, and not for the corporations that write these laws.
And that's why it's so important to go out and vote on April 3rd for all your local officials. Everything starts at the local level. Scott, thank you so much for being on today. I'd love to have you on again. I know you'll be on in a couple weeks, so I will talk with you then. Take care.
Sounds great. Have a great weekend.
Yep, you too. Thanks. That was Scott Wiskoff of Badger Democracy. The website is bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com. Coming up next is Kelly from Politiscoop. We're going to be discussing Bo Morrison.
something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and they carry inside. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Listen to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and on now is Kelly. She is one of the writers from Politiscope. Good morning, Kelly. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. Now, you guys have been amazing at following the Beau Morrison case. You guys have written three or four articles about it already. Can you go over why this case has caught your interest so much?
The Castle Doctrine legislation really outraged me when they were passing it, and I was watching it unfold on the floor of our house. And I've always been concerned about this very thing happening since they started talking about the Castle Doctrine.
Okay. And so since it happened, you're following. I mean, I was. As soon as they passed it, I thought, gosh, how long before this is actually going to be used? And it actually saddens me to realize that it was just a couple of months.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, I don't even know if it was 3-4 months after they passed it. And it's just awful. It's an awful tragedy. It never should have happened. And, you know, as I was reading the story and trying to get more information and investigating this and looking into the actions that happened that night, you know, I just realized that there's way too much, that stuff just doesn't add up. It doesn't seem like it's a case of self-defense or, I'm outraged. I cannot believe that this is happening and that there's no investigation into this. I mean, they did an investigation, but it was not justice for Beau.
Well, you guys had a really good article called Police Redact 911 Call Castle Doctrine Answers, and you went through a timeline through that. Do you want to go through some of that timeline? Because it seems like reading – from your blog and your article that things don't always add up.
Exactly. Just to give a little background, at 1 o'clock a.m., Mr. Kine left his residence to ask someone inside his car, inside their car, to turn down the loud music they were playing. And after a verbal confrontation with someone in the car.
I'm going to cut you in. Mr. Kine is the alleged shooter at this point?
Yes, he's the homeowner.
Okay.
Mr. Kine returned home and he called the police. This was at about 1 a.m. And he felt safe enough to go out there and confront these kids in the car with their loud music. And at 1:05 a.m., two Springer police cars arrived at the home of the neighbor, his name is Tim Hess. And his three daughters were hosting the party in the family's detached garage. Now, this house is right next to Mr. Kine's house. The garage sits right behind the porch where Bo was murdered. After 40 minutes, the two squads decided that they would withdraw and just issue citations to the Hess girls in the morning. And one officer parked across the street at a restaurant, and the other parked in a few hundred feet behind the Hess residence, which is behind the garage where the party was going on. At 1:50 a.m., the first officer called Mr. Kine to explain the situation, that they had backed off and were waiting for the kids to come out or they were going to issue citations. Kine actually even said, the officer commented that he appreciated and agreed that he would provide a written statement the next day. At 1:55 a.m., the same officer called the mom at work because they couldn't get the father, who was sleeping in the house, awake. So they spoke with her. She called and got her husband up, and the Slinger police had told them not to go and approach them until they got there. So at 1:55 a.m., the police were en route to the neighbor's home. That's where it gets really hokey to me. It doesn't make any sense. At 1:55 a.m., the police were in the neighborhood, if not next door. And the 911 call came in at 1:59:36 a.m. That was 4.5 minutes after the police had hung up the phone with Mr. Kine. How is it that the police did not hear a gunshot?
Now, how close were they? Do you know how close they were to the house at that time?
Well, in the report, it says that the officers were dispatched to the neighbor's home to meet up with Mr. Hess, the neighbor's kid's father that was having the party. And on that article, we also posted a map that shows the garage it can't be 50 feet away from their porch. And how did the officers not hear a gunshot? And why, if Mr. Kine felt that he needed to call the police about the loud noise in the car and report those kids for that loud noise, why is it that he doesn't feel compelled when he hears a banging noise, which I'm assuming was Mr. Hess knocking down the garage door to gain entrance where the kids were? Why didn't he feel the need to call the police when he heard what he suspected was people breaking into his home? But yet he felt compelled to call the police for a loud noise disturbance. And then in the report, it also shows a discrepancy between Mr. Kine and his wife's accounting of what happened. He says that he came up to the bedroom with to share the what happened with the conversation with the police at 1:50 a.m. And that's when he heard the loud noise, loaded his gun, and went down to check it out. His wife says that he came to the room and told her he heard a loud noise. Now, if my husband were loading a gun, which we don't own a gun, never will, but I don't have a problem with other people owning a gun, but if my husband were loading a gun because he heard a noise that he thought someone was breaking into their home, I'd have been on the phone calling 911. I would not have waited until after my husband shot someone on the porch. And then another thing that doesn't make any sense to me is he says that he went and checked the front door to see if it was locked. And he went to the back door. Now, where the porch, that's the entrance to the porch, why didn't he just lock that back door, secure his house, and call the police? Why did he open that door? And then another thing that I don't get, and it outrages me even more, and I feel awful even saying this because I pray for the family and their friends that are impacted by this, and no one wants to hear this, but Bo was found by the police still in the crouched position he was in, hiding, cowering, as he was shot. He was not standing up, coming at Mr. Kind, like he says. He was not in any danger from Bo. He put himself into danger by walking out that door.
And when he was shot, he was basically killed instantly. Is that not correct from one of your articles?
Yeah, he died. He bled to death. He was shot, and another thing is they count that the bullet was found in the wall 49 inches up, which means Bo was not standing up when he was shot through the heart and lung. He was not standing up. He was still sitting down, crouched down.
What kind of gun was he shot with?
I think it was a Colt, a 45 Colt.
Okay. And has the alleged shooter been charged with anything?
He has not, and the DA has said that they are not, that they felt that it was self-defense. They didn't even rule it under the Castle Doctrine, which actually is important because under the self-defense, the family could file a civil suit against Mr. Kind for, like, wrongful death or whatever. I'm not a lawyer or anything, but under the Castle Doctrine, the legislators that slammed this through decided that it was important that that the families of the victims not have any way to get any kind of justice, and they can't even file a civil suit. Also, in the 911 call from the police, I'm equally outraged because they redacted parts of the 911 call from the public view.
Now, be careful with this. I know what some of these words were. I don't have a bleep button,
yeah,
so be careful with this.
Yes, exactly. In the call, you can hear the, and I don't remember what market is at, and I know it's in our article, but you can hear very clearly in the background what I assume is the shooter, Mr. Kind, yelling, "You stupid effing," and it cuts out. And it comes back in the middle of Mrs. Kind's sentence, like in the middle of a word. So we knew that they had taken part of that 911 call out. So we contacted the Washington County Sheriff's Office and requested a full version of the 911 call, where they admitted that they did redact some from it. They claimed that they were taking out the name of the homeowner, which is public record, so I don't understand why they would do that. But when asked what was the finish of that sentence, the sheriff said that it was the word kid. I find it interesting that they felt they needed to edit that word out. Why would they need to take out the word kid?
You know, I've heard 911 calls on radio and on media before, and usually they just bleep out the words they don't want you to hear, the address or the person or name or whatever it is. It's interesting that they actually seemed, according to you, they seemed to cut this out.
Yeah, well, they admitted that they cut it out. But they won't release the, they're ignoring our pleas to release the original version. It's all part of public record, you know, the address, the names, it's all part of the public record. So there's no reason for them to withhold this original 911 call unless there's a cover.
Now we have about 2 minutes left, and I'm wondering what attention has the major newspapers, TVs, and radio in the state given to this incident, the shooting?
Well, the Ed Show covered it last week, but there hasn't been any more coverage on it. It seems that they're concentrating on Trayvon, which is just as outrageous. But we really need to put pressure for them to release the 911 tape and to have full transparency and to open up this investigation again and look into this a little deeper. And I would ask that maybe everybody contact the Washington County Sheriff's Department and ask them to release the 911 call for the public to get full transparency on what happened that night.
Okay. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for keeping us informed about Bo and the Bo Morrison case, I should say. And as things break, I'd like to have you back on talking more about this. I think it's important that we talk about it, and I'm so glad that you guys are following this as closely as you are. So thank you so much.
Thank you. We really need to keep this in the forefront of the media. We need to put pressure on these people to do the right thing and give us justice for Bo.
And for people to read, it's politiscoop.com. Is that your website?
Yep. Politiscoop, PolitiScoop.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kelly. We'll be talking with you in the future then.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for everything you're doing.
Thank you. You have a good day now.
Bye-bye.
Right, bye. That was Kelly from Politiscoop. Obviously, we were talking about the Bo Morrison case. And I'm now going to go straight to Kevin Kane. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep, you are good. Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show. Now, we have about 10 minutes left. So I know I wanted to bring you on to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court and their possible decision. You're with, I don't know if I mentioned this, but you're with Citizens Action Wisconsin. You guys are really good with healthcare. So can you give an overview of what's happened this week with the Supreme Court?
Sure thing. I'll try to see if I can condense 3 days' worth of Supreme Court cases to 10 minutes.
Or less, if you can.
Okay, gotcha. All right. So this week had the Supreme Court case. It was a three-day process. There was a number of provisions that they challenged. Started Monday, went all the way to Wednesday. Probably one of the largest Supreme Court cases since the 1930s for ruling on something that impacts so very many people. It was certainly a very interesting case. The main provision that they brought up was around this individual responsibility clause, the part that encourages people to be able to purchase health insurance. It's sort of a free rider tax, really. It's what it's saying is if you want a free ride and make sure everyone else has to pay more because you don't choose getting health care and you make us all suffer more, then you should be able to pay some sort of penalty. So that was what was brought up this week. It started day one with the question of, can the court even make a decision on this? Because the first rule one of key rules in the legal world is that you can't really challenge something unless you've been impacted by it. And since the penalties don't really kick in until about 2014, 2015, the question is, can they even rule on this today? They sort of sidestepped that, although it might come up in the future. And so the remaining time, Tuesday and Wednesday, was a discussion of can the individual mandate, is that constitutional? Is the individual mandate, is that something that could be taken out of the law and the law can still stand? If you take that part out of the law, Is there any part that has to go with it? Are they so interwoven that to take one out is to take them all? I guess the one question that was brought up a number of times is, I mean, would America be better with half a loaf or no loaf? Is that what they were trying to decide when it came to what Congress wanted? Do you want a little bit of something or do you want nothing? Personally, myself, I believe this entire law is constitutional. We will discover that. Another issue that got brought up was around the Medicaid expansion. It's kind of an interesting discussion there that the states are all saying that by making it so they can get Medicaid easier by expanding it, that's somehow damaging them, despite the fact that they're now getting Medicaid funding for more individuals than they necessarily have had. So there was a lot of cases heard. I've been listening to the court cases and reading the transcripts. They're all available online for anybody who wants to listen or read through them. But this is going to be very interesting landmark legislation wherever it's going to be. And so they're actually going to be voting on it today in the Supreme Court to decide the constitutionality of it. But they're not going to let people know about it until the end of June, mid to end of June. So they're going to take all that time to write the legal briefs and decide how historic this is, because this is going to be discussed and looked over and read by scholars and law students alike for generations and generations. And so this is a huge, huge court case. We're going to see where this ends up. But from my own personal perspective, I completely believe that this law is completely constitutional, and we will not have to worry about that. So what this means for Wisconsin, if they do somehow decide that that individual mandate, the individual responsibility is somehow unconstitutional, they're going to make a decision, can that be taken out, and if there's anything that has to go with it. So, I mean, if that part has to be taken out, do we also have to get rid of the part that says individuals now have a new place to go to purchase health insurance that they didn't before, that protects them, that gives them more options, that makes sure that they can't be discriminated against, or does that have to be taken out too? Does it impact the 2.5 million young adults under 26 who now have health insurance that didn't before? Do we have to take that out too? Because a lot of extra parts got put into this law that's not necessarily related to that requirement to get insurance. So the court is going to be deciding, you know, what's worth keeping and what's not.
Well, I find it very interesting because I know State of Wisconsin is one of them who filed against this. And I find it interesting because as a public official or as a public worker in the state, you have to have insurance. If you want to opt out of your insurance through public state, if you're a public worker again, you want to opt out of insurance, you actually have to prove you have another insurance to go to. If you cannot prove or do not have another insurance that you're going to fall back on, you are not allowed to remove your insurance. So how is that different from what they're fighting with the Affordable Care Act?
It's very similar, and see the whole thing is that we're very responsible people. We want to make sure that individuals are able to get coverage. I think most Americans want to have the ability to have coverage. They want that. There's not a ton of people who go out there saying I proudly don't have insurance and I never will. That's not an issue. So what we're doing is we're making sure that those individuals who don't get health insurance, most of the time it's because they can't, not because they don't want to, but they don't become a burden on the rest of us. I mean, we pay. There's a large premium that individuals end up having to pay for all those people that don't have coverage and now go to the emergency room, and we have to pay. We have to recoup those costs for hospitals and other providers. And so what this requirement is it's just another it's a penalty on freeloaders, those who want to – or free riders, excuse me, penalty on free riders who want to push the cost for the rest of us up. And that's infringing on our freedom just as much. I mean, they're forcing us to have to pay more because they don't personally think they don't want to take the responsible option there.
Well, would this even be a discussion if there was a single payer option within the Affordable Care Act?
It's really interesting you mentioned that, actually. A couple of the justices actually brought that very question up. I mean, Congress has made the decision back in the 30s in the number of decades in the past on topics like Medicare and Social Security, large overarching programs that were not necessarily market-driven like this law was. And they declared that that was absolutely constitutional, that was absolutely something that they had the power to do. So they brought up that issue. Had healthcare been more of a single-payer system, that would absolutely have been constitutional. And so if for some reason they decide to throw this entire law out, which I do think is very unlikely, that would be the remaining step. I mean, we have to look at that as the other option on the table, because they've declared that this particular way of doing things, our market-driven way of making sure that everybody has access to some form of coverage without having to be denied because of conditions that are, say, pre-existing. If they say that that's not allowed, then the only other option is single payer, and they actually brought that topic up. So that's a very good point.
Now, if they were just to rule on those two aspects of the act, why would they throw the entire act out? Why would they throw the whole thing out?
The question is, can you take a part of a law out? Is it severable? Is it something that you can take part of it out without having to get rid of the entire thing? Now, look, this law does a lot of other things that aren't related to it. It helps refund a program that ensures that Native Americans can still get health care. It helps make sure the young adults can stay on their parents' policies. The other side is going to argue that this part, this individual responsibility, is so important to the law, to things like insurance, premiums, and all the rest of that, that you have to get rid of the rest. Now, that's just silly because you think of all the different changes that this law does. I mean, it helps end the Medicare Part D donut hole and all the rest of that. But they're going to argue that if this one little part of it's bad, then the whole law can't be good and we have to throw it out. Obviously, Congress passed this whole law because that's what they needed. In fact, one of the justices brought that issue up. We decided that everything is legal except for, say, that Cornhusker kickback that went to Nebraska. We decided that somehow wasn't legal. Is this whole law going to be thrown out? And they even said that doesn't make sense. And so they're going to rule on that, but I find it unlikely that they're going to strike down the whole law.
And we'll find out, you said, in June.
Yes, that's the timeline that looks like it's going to come out on.
And if people want more information on this, where could they go? What website would you direct them to?
Well, I would. If you wanted to read the transcript and listen to the audio itself, which is tons of fun, let me tell you, you can go to the Supreme Court's website. You can just Google it there. Otherwise, we're going to have more information on our Citizen Action website, citizenactionwi.org, and we'll be able to keep people apprised of what's going on there. So that'll be a great place to go.
Wonderful. citizenactionwi.org. And the Supreme Court. Thank you so much for being on. If you want to hold on a second, my producer is going to speak to you, so just keep on there, okay, Kevin? But thank you so much for being on today for last minute, and we'll, as soon as we hear anything and have any kind of answers come down, we'll definitely have you on again to discuss that and what the implications are to Wisconsin.
My pleasure, anytime.
All right, thanks, Kevin. Hold on there. Well, that was Kevin Kane from Citizen Action Wisconsin, and again, his website is citizenactionwi.org. I'd like to thank you so much for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for all his hard work on the show. And I'd also like to thank the Tools for their song, We Will Not Break. That was from the Tools. They are a wonderful Wisconsin band that was played at the bottom of the first hour. You can listen, you can download the show from iTunes or listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones and iPhones. That's a free app you just download. You can listen to all the archive shows there. You tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to WIDE 99.1 LPFM in Madison. On Tuesday at 1 p.m. to WHYS 96.3 LPFM in Eau Claire. And on Sundays at 8 a.m. to WFAQ 92.9 LPFM in Mukwonago, Waukesha. Now remember, Wisconsin, the spring election is April 3rd. Be a voter and have a say in your government. Go out and vote. Have a great week, everyone. I'll catch you next Friday for my one-year anniversary show.